You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Noise, noise, noise. More than just a nuisance. The onslaught of 21st century noise is hazardous to our health. But it's tough to convince policymakers of this threat because you can't see it, you can't smell it, and it's hard to measure just how much noise each of us is exposed to. That has led Apple to partner with the University of Michigan. The goal? Measure how much sound that we are being exposed to. Richard Neitzel is leading this research effort at U of M. He's an associate professor of environmental health sciences and of global public health at U of M School of Public Health. Good to have you with us, Richard.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you have been studying noise pollution for quite a few years, some 20 years or so.
More than I care to think of at this point, but yes, 20 or so.
What is noise pollution? Give us some examples.
So noise pollution is just sound in the environment that we don't want or that is harmful to us. So that can include things like aircraft, buses, cars, your neighbor's noisy dog, the Amtrak going by in the middle of the night, and everything in between.
Leaf blowers.
Absolutely. Yes, in fact, yard maintenance equipment are typically right up at the top in terms of annoyance. But I don't just study annoyance. I'm more interested in direct impacts on people's health.
What do most of us not understand about what all this noise exposure is doing to our health?
I think most of us will acknowledge, if pushed, that too much noise probably causes hearing loss. And that's absolutely correct. But what we're learning, particularly in the last couple decades, is that hearing loss may just be the tip of the iceberg. There's an increasing body of evidence that links noise to heart attacks, to hypertension, potentially to stroke, to cognitive impacts, perhaps mental health impacts as well. So as we learn more and more about noise, we're realizing that really hearing loss is just one of a whole host of things, all of which are harmful to our health. The disruption of sleep is one mechanism that noise may harm our health through. So we know absolutely that if you don't sleep well, that puts you at much elevated risk for things like hypertension and heart attacks. But we also find hypertension and heart attacks among workers, and most workers don't get paid to sleep on the job. So there's something else at play here. And it turns out that noise is a general stressor of your system as well. So even if you're not realizing it, that noise exposure is activating your fight or flight reflex. You're having an adrenal response, and that releases hormones that can lead, again, directly to things like heart attack.
Looking at Michigan, how much noise pollution do we have in our state?
Well, so one of the problems we have is that we don't have good data on this. In fact, it's only been in the last couple of years that we've started to generate maps of where noise is in the United States, Michigan included. And these maps are useful, but they're very limited. So they come from the Department of Transportation, and they focus specifically on roadways and aircraft. And those are two important sources of noise, but they're not the only sources of noise. So where we've really fallen down is knowing how you and I and our individual behaviors might add to that background aircraft and roadway noise. Do you have a noisy job? Do you shoot guns? Do you have other noisy hobbies? So this has been a black box forever because we simply haven't had the ability to make measurements at the individual level on a large enough group of people to say how much noise do Michiganders or Americans have.
And enter the study with Apple. So what is this study about? How are you working with Apple?
So Apple is funding this study with the University of Michigan, and we're partnering to look at what we hope is a very large sample of people, and we're taking advantage of technology that's really available for the first time. So using their iPhone, people will be able basically to measure how much exposure they get to music through their headphones. And this has been sort of the holy grail for understanding noise exposure forever. We've never had good tools to do that. Now, for the first time, we will. People who have an Apple Watch will also be able to contribute information about their surrounding noise levels. So now, for the first time, if people have an Apple Watch and a phone, we can get a sense of what their total noise exposure is for all the things they do during the day, including listening to music. This is groundbreaking.
And how would this work then? I mean, would you have an app? Then would the app be listening, air quotes?
Absolutely right. So this is absolutely a voluntary study, so people consent into this. In fact, Apple has created something called the Research App. And so if people download this Research App onto their iPhone, they'll then have an opportunity to review this and two other studies. And if they choose to participate, they can, again, choose to share certain types of information with Apple. Now, we are absolutely committed to maintaining privacy. Apple, in fact, never has information to people's identifying information. That's only available to us at the University of Michigan. But what people are sharing is the sound levels from their watch. watch, the music listening levels from their iPhone, and then another critical piece of this is the app will allow them to test their hearing from time to time. So really, we can start to connect their exposures to their health impacts. The watch also enables us to measure people's heart rate, so we can start to connect noise to a cardiovascular outcome.
So you're going to get clearer scientific data than you've ever had before.
Absolutely. So we are kind of moving the scientific frontier forward here. The technology and the software available to us now are allowing us to do things that I, as a researcher, have wanted to do for 20 years, but have simply been impossible.
What could this mean in terms of policy decisions or things that policymakers could use to perhaps mitigate this?
So I actually see two major benefits out of the study. We'll come back to policy in a second. One of the benefits is to the individual. So as you participate in the study, you're going to get feedback on your own exposures. You may choose, ideally, to modify your exposures if you're getting too much noise and potentially putting yourself at risk. So that's the individual benefit, which is huge, I think. From a policy perspective, we'll now have at a national level an idea of what Americans are actually exposed to. This has always been guesses and supposition before. We'll have data now. And we'll have data not only on exposure, but on hearing impacts and on heart rate, as I said. So we'll be able to give policymakers for the first time a very comprehensive view of what noise is doing to public health, and ideally also give them recommendations about where do people seem to be getting their exposure from, what could be modified from a policy level to better protect public health.
Based on the research you have done, and understanding that it's going to be greatly advanced by this partnership with Apple, but what do we know, Richard, as far as which communities tend to be more affected by noise pollution? What does the research tell us?
Unfortunately, the research in this country is pretty sparse. We basically stepped out of the noise research field for the most part in about 1981.
Why did we do that?
So the Office of Noise Abatement and Control at our Environmental Protection Agency exists solely to study noise and make America quieter. And it was one of the first actions of the Reagan administration to defund that office. The office still exists on paper. They passed laws that are still in place, but there's nobody at home to enforce them. But we do know from other types of research a number of things. So we know that people who live in dense urban areas tend to have more noise. So the more people we crowd into a certain footprint, the more noise there's going to be. We also know that people who tend to live closer to transportation, a transit center, an airport, a seaport, they tend to have more noise. Further, we know that communities that tend to be low income and people of color also tend to have more noise, as well as many other environmental hazards. So there are definitely subgroups among us who have more exposure than a typical American.
We know, just kind of thinking around, of stories that we've seen in Michigan that sound walls are being built along some freeways. Ann Arbor has banned certain leaf blowers and outdoor equipment. Some houses in Detroit are being upgraded to mitigate the noise that will be coming from the Gordie Howe International Bridge. And a lot of communities have the ordinances that allow people to file complaints about noise pollution. Are these kind of grassroots efforts like this, is it enough to make a difference?
I have to believe that it absolutely is. I do want to come back to this idea of the Environmental Protection Agency. So we do have this federal office that was intentionally created to coordinate these activities, to sort of build on the grassroots, but also have some top-down approaches. So we actually have the political infrastructure in place to do a better job here. I think one other thing that's missing is just general public awareness. I think if people understood that this exposure was so common and so harmful, that might sort of entice them to be a bit more activist about this. But you're absolutely right. There are a number of local and state efforts in place, many of which have made dramatic improvements. We just need more.
What are the challenges in local enforcement?
Local enforcement is difficult. Some cities, for example, I used to live in the city of Seattle, had an ordinance that was enforceable by the police department, and the police department would actually carry a sound level meter in their cars. And so if there was a noise complaint, they could actually objectively evaluate the complaint and confirm if it was or was not a violation of the ordinance. Not a lot of communities have the resources to have all of their police officers also doing environmental health measurements. That's a challenge, too. Another issue is for things like sound walls, as you said. They can be incredibly effective, but they're very expensive. And so the notion of a small municipality collecting enough funds to build a sound wall is probably out of reach for most governments, which, again, is where the federal government can step in. And in fact, in some cases, big federal projects will require the implementation of noise controls. I find there's a sweet spot between there where there may be some grassroots efforts that can tap into existing federal or state resources to sort of maximize the opportunities there.
And speaking of the state, are there actions that can be taken at a state level? Because especially right now in the way that the things stand for the Environmental Protection Agency right now, a lot of these environmental protections are being unwound by the Trump administration.
So true and so very, very unfortunate. Let me actually give you a positive story here. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, lots of Americans were getting angry about a new noise source then, air traffic, specifically jet aircraft, to the point where there were many studies done that confirmed exactly what noise level it took to annoy exactly what fraction of the population. We know a lot about this. And America got upset about this, and they complained, and the politicians did something about it. So what they did is they told aircraft manufacturers, we don't care how you do it, but you are going to make your airplanes quieter, or they will no longer be able to fly in the United States. And there was a lot of dismay among the manufacturers, and then they figured it out. And as a result, we have about 95% fewer people overexposed to aircraft noise today than we did in the 1980s. That's huge, and it was a direct result of the federal government saying, we don't want to leave this to the states. We're actually going to pass a regulation, and we're going to force technology to adapt to make America quieter. It's worked before. It could absolutely work again. The problem is the states don't have the authority to regulate sources like that. What states can do, though, is implement educational campaigns, again, to raise awareness. They could perhaps think about allocating resources to noise control. You mentioned the Gordie Howe Bridge. That's absolutely an example of state and international partnership. So I think the states have a role here, as do local governments, and unfortunately, the federal government must act as well.
Well, fascinating work. Richard Neitzel, who's an associate professor of environmental health sciences and of global public health at U of M School of Public Health, partnering with Apple to measure just how much sound we're all being exposed to. Great talking with you. Thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.